Hello, welcome to another episode of Forensic Forecast. I'm Lee.
And I'm Simon.
Yes, he's a bit late on the uptake there. But he's alright. We like him anyway. how are you doing, Simon?
I'm doing well, even though I'm slightly older than I was last time we did one of these.
yesterday, the 9th of August, was Simon's birthday. So wish him a happy birthday, and I hope everyone feels the same way. Also, earlier this week, we were going to do this episode of Forensic Forecast, but Simon decided to go and have a hole put in his mouth instead.
Yeah, it was quite fun. Well, I say quite fun. What I mean is an experience I never want to repeat. Yeah, dentists aren't the best places to be at the best of times, but sometimes you've got to make things worse before you can make them better.
Yes. And,
I came out of the dentist feeling like I'd done at least a couple of rounds in a boxing ring with some heavyweight or other.
Excellent. Well, if it was a British heavyweight, you wouldn't have had anything to worry about, really, would you? Let's face it.
Yeah.
Couple of,
it depends on if they meet their weight class or not, really, and that kind of thing, doesn't it?
Well, no, I'm just thinking that we're crap at boxing, is all.
Yeah. Well, the dentist was very kind to me and said that I had that I seemed to have a good, strong jaw and a high pain threshold, so I would actually have made quite a good boxer. The only trouble is that you look below my jaw, and that's when things start to go a bit wrong. I think I could punch a moth and it would still fly away. I don't have the greatest upper body strength, but I could stand being hit in the face.
Yeah, it's like the episode of The Simpsons where Homer becomes a boxer, and all he does is he sits there and just takes all the abuse and punishment that people can dish out, and then they get so worn out that he just hits them once and they fall over. So you could employ that tactic, really, couldn't you?
I could do, if I wanted to suffer a lot of loss of brain cells very quickly.
Well, it's not like you're using them anyway, let's face it.
That's a fair point.
All right, well, I want to start off this week with an apology and a correction. Last week we spoke about Paul Sanderson's Revenge, which is a hex editor.
And the way you said that there, it sounded like a movie. Paul Sanderson's Revenge, coming soon to a theatre near you.
Well, unless I correct myself, it may well be the case. No, I'm just kidding. I am really sorry. I gave the impression that Paul had released the tool for free, or that he was going to release the tool for free, and he expressed a bit of concern about that. So I just want to apologise and just obviously... Now and again, I get carried away in some of the things I say, and I am very sorry for that. But put that aside, that's over. We want to talk about the main topic that we've set aside for today, which is virtual vigilantism. And it's going to branch out. We're just going to talk about stuff that's done online, but about possibly a couple of other areas as well. But the reason that I wanted to bring this up is because I've had this case recently, which involved something along these lines. A guy had been speaking to what he thought was a 12-year-old girl, ends up being not a 12-year-old girl, but one of the men off the website catchaperv.com, which is a UK site. Set up by a couple of former university students. And what they do, these guys, they go on, they pretend that they're young children, you know, preteens or whatever, and they talk to these different guys online, get them into a private chat, like on MSN or something like that, get them on webcam. And all the while, they're recording the webcam conversation and everything with like some kind of screen capture software. Then eventually, they reveal themselves to this alleged perv predator, and they obviously then panic and switch off the computer and everything. Now, the main reason why I wanted to talk about this is because I foresee some difficulty with websites like this. But there's a few others like it. We've got the group called Perverted Justice, who they claim to have been responsible for jailing hundreds of so-called predators. And they're also behind, well, they were one of the people behind the Dateline show, the MBS Dateline show, To Catch a Predator. What happened in that show, Simon?
That was an interesting show. I've actually been able to see a couple of clips of them over the internet from time to time. And it's a show where basically they set up situations kind of like, I guess a bit like a sting situation where someone will pretend to be a young girl or something like that, and we'll talk to someone, we'll arrange to meet up or something. And when this person shows up wherever they've arranged to meet, they're then confronted with a TV presenter or something, possibly some kind of police authority that might be there, and they're essentially showing up to be an internet predator.
Yeah, so basically, these guys, they chat to someone who they think is underage, they arrange to meet them, and bang, that's it, they're caught. Yep. Cameras in their face, they're put out on television and stuff, and they're there for the world to see, essentially. I mean, like you said, you even saw a few of these clips on the internet, and I'm sure if you went tracking around on YouTube, it'd be quite easy to find these people. But, you know, things like To Catch a Predator, websites like catchaperv.com, what they do, they put the pictures up there, they name these people, they say where you can, you know, basically who they are, what they do, where they live. And also the Perverted Justice website has also put on, you know, information such as people's home address and home telephone number and the like, which is really quite intrusive, I think. But it's difficult to say, isn't it? Because you can't say for sure, one way or the other, that these guys are doing a good job or they're doing something which is a real hindrance to law enforcement.
Yeah, it depends on the level they go to. As you say, with that, the last one, on the idea of actually giving out a specific address or phone number for some of these people, it's a bit much, really. And it's not for these people to decide what these people are guilty or not guilty of. That's for courts to decide. And when they make actions like that, they're just going to cause issues further down the line, aren't they?
Yeah, well, that's... You think you've hit the nail right on the head there. Is it, these virtual vigilantes, I've coined that phrase, I hope that's fine with everyone. If I go back to this case that I was working on, I mean, this initial conversation between this guy and this fake 12-year-old happened 2 years ago, and we've only just analysed the computer, so it's been 2 years since the incident happened. Now, you know, I mean, what was the first thing you would do, for example, Simon, right? If you'd been caught talking to someone online who you thought was underage, or you were doing something illegal and someone came up online and said, haha, gotcha, what would be the first thing you would do at that point?
I would probably wipe my hard drive, then I'd smash it into small pieces and throw it in a lake. Something a bit over the top and paranoid, but
it might...
you find some ways so that you don't get caught of what you've done, don't you, really?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I thought. You know, if it had been me, and like you, like, wipe the hard drive, absolutely get rid of it if you can. You know, chuck it out. Make sure that no one is going to find that stupid thing. Because last thing you want to do is get caught. And if all the people have got is their end of the conversation, it's going to be... you know, pretty difficult. It's not impossible, but it's going to be difficult to show that it was that person who was involved with with the in the whole operation, and that it wasn't a setup or anything like that. So 2 years after this incident happened, the computer arrives at our offices. I do the analysis on it, and there is really nothing of any interest there. I mean, you've got him doing all just regular web browsing, but no web history from 2006. You know, nothing, no saved chat conversations. There's just, even going through an allocated space and trying to find portions of the chat there, because I had the whole transcript of the chat taken off the website as well. But just nothing, 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 nothing. And this guy is just basically, you know, I don't know. I can't judge this because we don't know how many times this guy might have done it. This might have been the one and only time he did it, and it wasn't actually a 12-year-old girl. You know what I mean? So it's difficult to say, really, whether, you know, you can't say what he is. You can't say what he might have done. But looking at his computer, and from the very, very limited evidence that's on there, the guy is going to walk anyway. And if he had actually been, like, a real sexual predator who was, you know, baiting 12-year-old girls on the internet, then these guys at catchaperv.com have tipped him off and could possibly have stopped a full-blown investigation and stopped, you know, prevented the law enforcement helping someone who really needed help.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that a lot of people don't really consider is the fact that the police and law enforcement in general are quite good at things like sting operations and catching people unawares. And people who run these sorts of campaigns and websites, they don't have the same approach. They grab the evidence there and then and publish it to the world.
Yeah.
And that, of course, means that there's a high chance of these people going into hiding in a manner of speaking or making sure that they can't be caught for things.
Well, the other thing about the media publicising this stuff as well is that they can be selective in what they show, and they can make these people seem really quite bad when they may not be. You know, it's difficult to say. The other thing as well is that you got this whole entrapment case as well, haven't you? Mm-hmm. With the police, you know, they take detailed notes on what's being said. They record everything about what's being done, so they know that if this guy comes back and says, oh, it's entrapment, then they can go back and say, well, actually, no, this guy initiated the conversation. He was the one who turned it sexual. He was the one who brought up meeting. And that happens over a long period of time as well. That's not just one meeting and then, bang, they're going to go and find the guy. Some of these things can take, you know, several months with the same guy. And to just go one, you know, waltzing in and say, right, this guy is a perv, we're going to put him on TV. We're going to post his picture on the internet. We're going to let everyone know who he is. It's pretty damaging to people. And in fact, there was one guy who, through that show To Catch a Predator, killed himself. He was a associate district attorney in Texas, and he was rumbled through that. And rather than live with the tag which Dateline had pinned on him, he killed himself instead. Now, Dateline, as a result of that, are getting sued for $105 million because of the way they handled everything. And I just wonder, you know, if it had been the police who had dealt with this straight off instead of Dateline getting involved, would the same result have come up?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, it's possible it could have ended up the same way.
Well, yeah.
It's obviously highly likely that if he's if he's taken that action with one scenario, he might have taken it with another. But at the same time, it doesn't help if you're in this situation, all of a sudden you've been found guilty without trial, essentially, by a TV show. And millions of people will have seen that and will know who you are and what you've allegedly done.
Yeah, I mean, also, the chance of getting a fair trial over something like that is also very, very difficult to achieve, isn't it? Because if you've had your face plastered all over TV saying, you know, this guy showed up to have sexual relations with a 15-year-old girl and we've got him on TV, and they put up a picture of him and they say who he is and where he's from and everything, if he goes to court, you have to find 12 people to sit on that jury who don't have a clue who this guy is, who don't know anything about the backstory, and who haven't been told anything about it. And it's difficult. It just makes the whole scenario a lot more difficult, in my opinion.
Yeah, it certainly makes a fairly commonplace kind of thing a lot more high profile than it would otherwise be, and it just... The rules of court cases for celebrities and probably have to apply to these sorts of cases after that.
Yeah.
And just it does. It makes something that could be a fairly routine investigation quite complicated.
Yeah. The other thing I ask myself about these as well. You know, like I said a bit earlier, depending on who you talk to, you know, there's going to be people who champion this kind of thing and say, this is fantastic, this is exactly what we need to do. The police are overstretched in investigating these kinds of things. They don't have the resources or the manpower. It's ideal for these guys to go in and to be like, yes, come on, we'll catch them, we'll deliver them straight to the police, and they can, they can conduct their own investigation from there. But on the other side, you've got people who are going to say, well, wait a minute. Who are you? You have no right to go around doing this kind of thing. You possibly are going to jeopardise any investigation into this individual because, like we said earlier, the guy might then go and wipe his hard drive, get rid of his computer, just replace it, buy a brand new one, and anyone imaging that, doing an investigation or anything, wouldn't know any better. They would think, well, you know, it's a negative case. There's nothing on here.
I wonder if we should allow these people to do things, but first force them to obtain a private investigator license. The same sort of rules apply to this, don't they, really?
I tell you what, right? You're a genius. You are a genius. Yeah, that would probably work. I mean, you've got to be careful. If any of these people listening to this podcast, then, I mean, we're not taking sides. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm not saying to do it. All I'm saying is, you know, here are some of the consequences of what you're doing. So the first one is that you might not find any evidence whatsoever. Okay? You agree, Simon?
Yep.
All right. Another thing that might happen... I don't know if you heard this story or not, Simon, but a few months ago, there was a teenager hacked into someone's computer. And this kid had been doing it for a couple of years, and had found that this person had child porn on their computer. And I'm sorry about the term child porn, it's just easier to say. Hacked in, did all his bits and pieces, found all this evidence, and then called the police. The police went, they seized the computer. Yes, the stuff was all on there. And as far as I'm aware, this thing's proceeding to trial. Now...
It seems a bit strange, given that you're using an illegal method to obtain information that you want to then rely on in court.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I hate the phrase, two wrongs don't make a right, but that's exactly what's happening here, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems to be. We all know that hacking isn't something that you can do. It depends on the terms you want to add to the word hacking.
The illegal entry into someone else's computer.
Yeah, you can't force your way into someone else's computer, breaking laws in the process, and say, "Oh, there's something illegal on there." There's something of a double standard there, really.
Yeah, and so I mean that would be that would be the first point of attack if I was the defense counsel. Okay, now the second line of attack from that point of view is, how do we know that this guy did anything wrong at all? How do we know that this kid didn't have some kind of vendetta against this person and go about spreading all this stuff all over the hard drive?
Or even, as a side note to that, if one person's hacked into this person's computer, how do we know someone else hadn't hacked into it previously?
Exactly. And so, in my opinion, this causes so much trouble. But there are individuals and groups that do this on a regular basis. And it's scary because the police still go and they prosecute the people that have been caught. All I can tell you, all it's going to take is one smart solicitor with who knows what he's doing to completely bring the whole thing down, and then there'll be an appeal list as long as your arm. So yeah, there's a few problems with this, isn't there? Obviously, I mean, you've got the risk of once the person's been caught that they destroy all evidence. You've also got people hacking into the computer to get rid of whatever's there. You've got the potential impact on the person's own life. And it's just, I just wonder if these guys who do this kind of thing are actually doing it for the right reasons as well.
Yeah, well, that's one of the criticisms of things like the show To Catch a Predator, because it's obviously run by a network TV show. And one that's looking at getting ratings and that kind of thing, so they want to make shows that are shocking and interesting and get people watching them.
Yeah.
And so there'd be a temptation to edit things so that they appeared to be in such a way that they would attract more viewers rather than seeing that justice was done.
Yeah.
That's one of several criticisms for things like that.
Yeah. I mean, There is a point where these guys stop being the solution to the problem that they perceive, and they start becoming the problem themselves.
There seems to be, and we're not in any way saying that when you discover some kind of illegal act that you don't report it or anything.
Oh, heavens no!
But when it's obviously got to be within the right kind of bounds. It's got to, if you go looking for some dirt on someone, eventually you're going to find it. And it's one of those things. If you find out in the course of your everyday things that something's happened, then by all means, go through the proper legal process. But taking the law into your own hands can be quite disastrous.
Yeah. Well, another thing that two things that occurred to me, really. There was another story a little while ago that was published in the press over here about some vigilantes who have probably taken it a little bit too far. Well, they have taken it too far. There's no question they have. And what happened is that they would go online, just like the Catch a Predator guys or the Catch a Perv guys or Perverted Justice. They would go out, deliberately bait these guys and say, "Hey, look, I'm 14 years old. Why don't you come and meet me at this place at this time and we'll get it on." And this guy would show up having been propositioned, probably having not done a whole lot himself, and they would show up. All these guys would jump out of a van and beat the hell out of this guy and then just leave him lying on the road and drive off. And I just think, well, I know that it's difficult. I know that the police are stretched when it comes to this kind of stuff. But you cannot do stuff like that. It's madness. Because you end up becoming the criminal yourself. Obviously, the hacking into someone's computer is one thing, but this is completely over the top.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, if you feel like the police aren't doing enough, then go and volunteer as a kind of special constable or something. Do something to help the police out or something. Just do something sensible rather than trying to sort the world out on your own. It can be crazy, really, and it's knowing where to stop, really.
Yeah, I mean, the only way I can see these kinds of things working is that if you find someone, you haven't baited them purposely, they've come to you to initiate conversation, right? That has to be point one, doesn't it? You can't vary from that, because if you encourage that person, it's entrapment. In any way, shape or form, if you encourage them, it's entrapment, and they can claim that, and they'll likely get off with a caution or whatever else. The second part to this is that they have to turn these people over to the police straight away. Because if they don't, and they... let's take catchaperv.com for a second, okay? It's had a site redesign in the last year, so it's slightly different now. So if you go onto the page now, what you see is that you see pictures of these guys and a brief description of what happened, okay? And what the site used to have also like a comment section for each alleged predator which they'd caught. Now, these predators could go back online to this site, add their own comments and stuff like that, and say, you know what, this is a one-off thing, blah, 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 blah. And they get into an argument with the people that caught them, an argument with loads of other people involved as well. And what happens then is it just prolongs the process, and it makes things just get so much more complicated and worse. Report it to the police straight away. If you are going to be one of these online virtual vigilantes, don't bait them, report to the police straight away. It's the only way it can function. Because if you wait for any period of time at all, these guys, like we said, they can get rid of the evidence any way that they can think of, and just make things a lot worse. I mean, there's the other side to this as well, is that there was a Kelly Burke, who's a supervisor of the Exploited Child Unit at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. The website is cybertipline.com. She says, "We don't believe it helps deter those predators. Mainly, it moves the predators to different areas and pushes them to act smarter in concealing their identity." And I absolutely agree. I mean, if I thought there was those vigilantes out there trying to bait me into going to a meetup only to be arrested by the police or getting beaten up or put on film or something like that, then I wouldn't bother with that. I would look for alternative means to satisfy my my desires. And I just think that it's one of those things,
isn't it, that it's the same with all kind of criminal activity, I guess, and anything like it. As soon as you find ways to stop them, they'll find other ways of doing it. And as soon as you start making things like this quite high profile, then people will, of course, notice these kind of things and seek ways around what they've been doing.
Yep. So, I mean, you just got to look at it. I mean, like I said at the start, I'm undecided. I don't know whether these guys who do these kinds of things are actually having a positive effect or a negative effect. I mean, they'll sit there. I mean, what's that one called again? I can't remember. I just lost it at the top of my head. Perverted Justice. They say that they... Let's just have a look at the statistics a second, because the website claims 275 convictions in 39 states across the US attributed to its sting operations. 33 of these taking place in 2005, 81 in 2006, 141 in 2007, and 15 so far in 2008. And they're quite an extensive range of different charges and the like. But, I mean, they'll sit there and they can quote those numbers to you, but you have to wonder how many people have actually slipped through the net because they interfered as well. Have any? I don't know. There's no way of measuring that, is there? There's no way to say, either, that if they hadn't helped in the conviction of these 275 people, would they have been caught by another means instead?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think these kind of groups can be a good thing as long as they're working with law enforcement and as long as they're following proper procedures and these kind of things. But there's a temptation once you get into these kind of situations that you can you feel like taking matters into your own hand and doing things that you probably shouldn't do that might get in the way of legal process.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's difficult because you don't know one way or the other whether they are actually having a positive effect or not. And they can sit there quite easily and say, yes, we have had a positive effect. But at the end of the day, the effect is immeasurable because we have nothing to compare it to. So
yeah, that's true.
It's very, very difficult. Now, what I want to do is that me and Simon, I apologise, Simon and I were talking about this just before we started recording, and I really think that this would make a terrific documentary, so to speak. And so I think what we're probably going to do is that we're going to contact some of these organisations and say, you know, and get something official quoted from them. And we're going to try and put something together, maybe in video or something like that, and put it on the website. But I'd also like to hear everyone else's feelings on this kind of thing as well. Because, I mean, we're just, like I say all the time, we're just two guys who have an interest in computer forensics. But all you out there, you've got your own ideas and hypotheses on how to deal with things like this. So please give us your input. We'd love to hear. And we'll definitely discuss those at a later time as well. But, yeah.
Just something as a side note. You mentioned before what the catchaperv.com website used to be like. It might just be worth pointing out to any of the listeners who may be relatively new to forensic examinations or that kind of thing, how it is you go about finding out that kind of thing.
A good point. Very good point indeed. So, if you visit the website web.archive.org, isn't it?
I think it is. I believe so.
web.archive.org. No. Oh, wait a minute. I've mistyped. I went to web.archine.com, which obviously isn't the right site.
It's great when you do these things live, isn't it?
Yeah, whoa. So, if you go to web.archive.com, they've got something called the Wayback Machine. And what you can do is that you just type in the web address of that particular website. So, I don't know, let's take something quite generic. If we type in Microsoft.com and you click on the button next to where you typed it in that says Take Me Back, you're then presented with a list. And this list In Microsoft's case, it ranges from 1996 to 2008. And the Internet Archive, basically, it caches and takes a copy of as many websites as it can and stores those saved web pages. So, for example, if you click on the very first entry under Microsoft, it's October 20th, 1996. You click on that, and Microsoft's first website pops up. And it's quite amusing to have a look at some of it. Like for this one, for example, you've got "See what's new in Microsoft Publisher 97. And, you know, that's it's quite amusing and quite funny to just have a look through. But it's a very, very useful tool. Many different times you may come across a website in an investigation which you try to visit the URL to see what the website is, and it's just not there. It's disappeared completely. Going to web.archive.com, the Internet Archive, is probably the best way you're gonna have of finding what that website actually was. Useful resource. I'll put a link to it in the podcast description on the show notes. But yeah. So I think that this is quite a difficult topic to really cover in such a short space of time, really. So, well, I think, unless you've got anything to add, Simon, we're going to just stop there and we'll come back to it another time.
Yeah, yep. It's fine.
All right. Good, good. Just so everyone knows, in the next few weeks, next week, I am away on training at Guidance. Simon is away on holiday the week after that. Yep.
Yeah, well, I can still do this kind of podcast if required.
All right, so hopefully we won't miss that episode. But and then the following week, I'm away, and I might be able to do an episode then. I don't know, but we're going to get it sorted somehow. We're gonna make sure we don't miss too many, if we miss any at all. But in coming episodes, we're going to talk to a couple of people. We're going to talk to a guy called Mark McKinnon, who has written some software called Drive Profit, which is like a triage tool for going in and examining, it's difficult to say, really. Get just basically an outline of the computer before you actually start performing an investigation on it. He's also got another tool, which I need to get his permission to talk about, I think, more than anything else. We've also got Matthew Shannon from F-Response, and we've got some software from him that we're going to be testing over the next couple of weeks, and then hopefully once we've done that, we'll get him on to talk about his software as well. We've got a guy called Larry Sewell from Guidance, who's offered to come on and talk to us about the NCASE Lab Edition and so on and so forth. So we've got some interesting guests coming on, and we, you know, if anyone knows of anyone else we need to talk to. Oh, also, yeah, I forgot. How can I forget? Apologies. But also, Harlan Carvey, the writer of Windows Forensic Analysis, he's also agreed to come on and do a short interview with us as well, just find out a little bit about him and about what his book's about. So, yeah, it's impressive. It's impressive, the contacts that we make through doing this podcast. This is only episode 6. Who knows where it's going to go in the future? It's amazing. But
see if we can line Bill Gates up in a few weeks or something.
Yeah.
Maybe not that big yet.
No. Maybe we'll have to settle for Steve Jobs first.
Yeah, maybe.
But
we'll aim low, shall we?
But yeah, I mean, we hope to do more of this kind of stuff as things go along, because I think that all you guys want to hear stuff like that. I just think it'd be interesting. So hopefully it will all go according to plan. All right. You got anything you wanted to bring up, Simon?
Just a rather amusing story I discovered today.
Okay.
It's about a bunch of cheerleaders, essentially. And
trust you.
What are you trying to say?
I'm not saying anything.
Yeah, I should hope not. But yeah, while attending a cheer camp in Texas, a group of teenage cheerleaders decided they were going to have a bit of fun and see how many cheerleaders they could fit into an elevator or a lift, depending on where you are and how you'd say it. And they decided to really cram in, see how many they could get in. They could, and they managed to fit 26 cheerleaders aged between 14 and 17 into this space. And then they decided that not only were they going to fit into the lift, but they were going to travel between floors. So they travelled from the fourth floor of this building to the first floor. But then the doors didn't open. And so while all crammed in there, a bit of manoeuvring around, a couple of the girls managed to reach their mobile phones and to call for help.
That's a cell phone.
It still took 25 minutes for a repairman to be able to come out and get them released.
Fantastic.
Luckily, no one appeared to have been seriously injured in the incident, but I'm sure they'll think again, and one or two may well have phobias of small spaces as a result.
Great stuff. That's a fantastic story. Geniuses. That's why they're cheerleaders and not forensic analysts. Just quickly. And people are going to get the impression that I just don't want to let this go. But I really would like people's feedback on these private investigator laws, how they are affecting people out in the real world. I spoke to someone the other day who he said he felt quite screwed because either he had to go out and basically be an unpaid intern for a private investigator for a while, or he'd have to go and try and join a company which is already registered as a private investigator, and they're few and far between, apparently. So I'd really like to hear people's experiences on this. Is it preventing you from doing your job? Is it causing you, you know, quite a lot of stress? Just let us know. We really, really would like to know about this for a future episode, because this is still the most significant issue in forensics at the moment, in my opinion. So we're going to come back to it. We are going to revisit it. So yeah, just send us email, comments on the website, however you want to do it. We'd love to hear about how it's affecting you. Just quickly, one other story that I don't know where it's come from because it's not on the Access Data website. There's a story on Forensic Focus. Access Data adds network forensic technology to product profile. And its story is very vague. Access Data has announced the addition of network forensics capabilities to its product portfolio. And that's essentially all that it says. And there's nothing on the Access Data website. So I don't know what on earth...
What does that mean?
Well, you know, your guess is as good as mine.
That they already have some sort of level of network capabilities, don't they?
Yes.
In that... acquisitions and things can be done over a network. Does it mean more than that?
They have enterprise edition. They have an enterprise edition of their software. I don't know what they're getting at, if I'm completely honest. I'll keep my eyes open and see what pops up in the next few days, but that is bizarre. Oh well. You know,
someone out there might know something more. If you do, let us know.
All we do is just we tell it how we see it, yeah, and that
like catchphrase.
Say what you see. So, yeah. I think we've probably run out of things to talk about now, have we?
I think we may well have done.
Well, we've done all right. 45 minutes isn't too bad. All right. Well, hopefully there'll be a more news-packed episode next time you hear from us, which will be in about a week and a half, as I'm not here this week. So we'll bid you all adieu. Bye for now.
Bye.